Hello and welcome. It's our bonus Q&A episode of the Books of the Year podcast in the studio with Chris Chibnall. His new book is The Parkwood Murders. We've discussed that in our previous episode if you want to check that out. But here we go with the questions, Chris, to you. What is the last book that you really, really enjoyed reading?
It was London Falling.
Yes.
Which I think is currently number one in the hardback charts. Patrick Radden Keefe. And I didn't read it. I listened to it.
Me too.
On audio. Amazing.
And he can read his own stuff very well.
Yeah. He's really good, isn't he? He can do everything. I just thought it was an incredible piece of writing, piece of journalism, told a story that made you look at the city differently. It's deeply emotional. It's deeply moral. The moral purpose behind the book, the outrage behind the book. And it's forensically precise as well. I just loved it.
The only things he gets wrong is a couple of English pronunciations.
Yes.
But I thought, oh, great, you're not perfect.
So I read it, so I didn't know. What did he...
I can't remember. It's like Americans can't say Leicestershire.
Right.
Do you remember where you got wrong?
No, I was trying to think, because it reminded me of whenever in Ted Lasso they talk about a football match being tied. And I'm like, it's a draw. It's a draw, not a tie. Come on, guys.
I think we're all in agreement on
that. It feels like that book is going to be the book this year, that because, as you say, it's number one. And it feels like everyone's talking about it. Is there an idea in a book or a plot that you wish you had come up with?
That's interesting. I was racking my brains on this. No, I'm normally more in admiration for those sorts of things. I don't necessarily feel envious of those things. Sometimes, you know, with a story like London Falling, where you just think that the ability to uncover that story, to dig at that story. I think it's, I mean, there are plenty of books I go, oh, well, that has just stayed with me for life when I think about Adrian Mole or The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy or something like that. But no, not particularly.
Have you ever had a mentor?
I have. When I was just starting out playwriting, I did an attachment at the National Theatre Studio, and my mentor was a writer called Barry Keefe, who was a playwright, and I'd done my dissertation at uni. I did drama at uni, and I did my dissertation on Barry Keefe. He was an amazing playwright. And so when they asked, who would you like to mentor you? I was like, well, if it could be anybody, it would be him. And they found him, and he mentored me. He also wrote the screenplay for The Long Good Friday. It's probably what he's best known for.
Wow, really?
He was incredible. Actually, he was actually going through incredibly hard times at that point. He was working at the Millennium Dome under a sort of employment scheme or something, and he was incredibly mordantly funny about that. I remember him saying about a few things, and he would say about these anecdotes, he would say, it tells better than it lived, and some of those things. But he was great, and he would just... One of the things that stayed with me that he said was about writing plays, he said, just write great parts for actors. And that notion of writing parts for actors, it really applies in TV and film as well, because that sense of you're writing a part and someone's got to want to get up at 5 o'clock in the morning and travel to a location and sit in makeup and be there till 8 o'clock at night. And it's like, it's really part of your job to ensure that those characters are really strong and worth other people living with over a prolonged period of time.
You certainly did that for Bob Hoskins, because that absolutely, goodness me, what a role. Do you always finish reading a book if you've started it?
No. I probably would give it 100 pages.
Yeah,
50 to 100 pages, and then
that feels
still
generous. I've got to say,
actually, as I said that, I was like, 50 to 100.
Yes.
How fast were you driving? 28 miles an hour.
Yeah. Okay, you got me. It was the laser look again. You see, Matt, straight as you looked me in the eye. I don't think it's not an obligational transaction, is it?
No, it's not.
It's, and also, if you've bought the book, you've done your part in the exchange. The author's very happy. So, not every book is for everyone, is it? But most of them, I'm try and be targeted about what you purchase, don't you? I think we shouldn't be precious about books in terms of they shouldn't be homework. They should be inspirational and life-affirming and demand our attention.
Cool, all right.
Is there a book from your childhood that was very influential?
There are a number of things that I read when I was a kid. It's hard to isolate one, that because I read Agatha Christie when I was a teen from the library in Formby on Merseyside, where I was living then, and Famous Five and Secret Seven, I realised, were the gateway drugs, because they were mysteries as well, and murder mysteries, and I also read Terence Dix's adaptations of novelizations of Doctor Who stories as well. So those were the things. The book I read most, like before I was 16, multiple times, was Hunter Davis's biography of the Beatles.
Oh yeah,
which is an absolutely stunning book. But I think I got it when I was 11. John Lennon died when I was 10, and that sort of bang, I was the Beatles hooked forever. And that biography, and it's with a yellow paperback cover, and has gone with me throughout my life. And just, it's a very direct description of four people making art and changing culture and changing the world and passionate about what they do. And yeah, it's not a book I would instantly go, when you go, what are the influence? It's not really an influence, but it's a book that I treasure really deeply.
You're a great Spurs fan as well, Hunter Davis. Yes. Just thought I'd mention that.
Yeah, good for you. Yep. Good for you. I've just realised we are, not only are we the same age, we grew up in the same town. So I lived in Formby. Yeah.
No!
And given you were 10 when John Lennon was shot, I was born in 71 as well. So, yes, we will have been in Duke Street Park at the same time.
Yes.
Chris,
have you been to that library then, Matt?
Yes, I have.
That's absolutely where I got all my books.
There you go. There you go.
No, I'll just look up things on the internet while you two catch up.
There's not much else to say.
What is your writing routine, if you have one, and are there any snacks involved?
My writing routine is, I try and do an office day, basically. I write standing up, so I have a treadmill under my desk. So I sit standing and I put a treadmill under my desk.
On sprint?
Yeah, oh, yeah. Yeah, I'm on maximum all day long, 12 hours.
Wow.
No, it's on a sort of fast walking pace. And I thought this was... I saw somebody... I was in LA about 16, 17 years ago. I saw an executive with this under his desk, and I thought, what an idiot. And then about two or three years later, when I was... It started because I was under lots of deadlines on TV, and it's like I wasn't really leaving the house very much, and I was like, I really need to find a way to exercise. And so I got this and did this, and it takes a couple of weeks to get used to it. But so generally in the mornings, I'll have that on. So I'll turn up at somewhere between 9 and 10, depending on how interesting other things are in the house going on. And then I'll work till lunchtime.
So you're typing whilst you're walking.
Yeah. Right. And a break for lunch, and then back at it after probably about an hour, and then... terrible dead zone between 2 and 4 where I don't really manage to do anything, or just fiddle with three words or do emails. Yeah. And then 4 and 6 is a good time again. But usually it travels on in the morning, and then by 4 o'clock, I'm like, that's enough of that.
With snacks?
Snacks, some nuts. I've really tried to cut down on snacks. I'll have an apple in the morning and some nuts in the afternoon, maybe like a little Gray's proteiny thing. Yeah.
Honestly, officer, that's all I have.
I've had years where that has not been the case. Yes. And it's been Jaffa cakes. And,
good.
But I'm really trying not to do that.
Have you ever experienced writer's block? And if so, how did you get out of it?
I think sort of every day is like a thing of trying to fight against that, isn't it? I mean, deadlines make a difference. I think coming up through television, where you're having to deliver multiple episodes and there are people waiting to film the thing that you've written. So, which is probably a little like journalism as well, where it's just like the sort of the thing of the deadline is so important. And if I don't deliver that script, then it's going to cost £200,000 for all the delays and things like this. So it's I don't feel like I have this wood, this table, I'm touching that. But whenever I've hit a problem or a wall, and even actually in the past week, there's been something that's been really bugging me about a particular project, and actually walking, going out and walking, because I live in Dorset, so I live where the novel's set. I live a mile from the Broad Church Beach, and walking in that landscape and just taking that problem out for a walk, usually between 2 and 4 p.m., is the thing that makes my brain work at the problem subconsciously.
And then have a shower, because
because it's a vigorous walk, and then those would be the things. But I mean, it's all but there, but for the grace of God as a writer, isn't it? You just never know when you're just going to hit that wall.
Is there any order to your bookshelves at home, or is it all higgledy-piggledy, or anything at all?
It's all higgledy-piggledy.
Right, no order at all.
Rooms in the house. I've got a section in the office where I've got sort of writing-y industry books, producing books, film books. That's probably about it. And but generally. And obviously, you know, when I started living with my now wife, it's like your book collections merge, and so they all are. No, they're in various places, but I could probably find something. It's sort of there's a subliminal awareness of where certain books are, but I quite like that because they're all in conversation with each other.
Now you need to put headphones on for this. Question, because we always like to get a question from a fellow author.
Exciting.
Yes. So here is a voice note from your friend of mine, Russell T. Davis.
Oh, hello.
Chris, hello, it's Russell here, Russell T. Davis, and I've got questions for you about the Parkwood murders. I would love to know, did you actually go and stay in a holiday camp? Did you and Mrs. Chipnall and the little triplets stay in a lodge? Did you? To research this? I'd love to know that. I've also got a second question, which is how much has the success of Nicola and Westlife, a lovely assistant who I can only call Westlife, has that taken you by surprise? Because I love that story, and I want them to get together when she's happily married with a child. But have you leaned into that? Have your readers reacted to that? Was it planned this much, or have you run with it and gone further with it? Tell me about those two. I love them. I love you too. Lots of love, darling. Bye-bye.
Okay. I mean, you would think that Russell might have been more sound aware and maybe have a sound recorder do something properly without... Sounded like he was on a windy walk somewhere.
Do you know what? Because, of course, he's the busiest man in television, he's thinking, oh, no, I've got to do that question for him.
Yes.
I'm just walking down here. I'll record it now.
Okay. Well, we're very glad that he did. So, lodge research and the relationship between Nicola and Harry.
I've stayed at holiday villages, as discussed, many times, and that's what sort of put the idea in my head. I didn't do it specifically for research this time round, because also I wanted to create my own sense of the shape and the space of this particular resort. But I know them well. I've been there multiple times, and it's been ticking away in my head since all of those visits. With my kids across very different ages, from sort of 3 to 17, 18. Mm. So, yeah.
And the relationship between Nicola and Harry, certainly early on in the book, she's lying on the bed thinking about him, so...
Yeah, it's very deliberately written in there, and I think there's stuff in Death at the White Hart about where she is in her life, where she is in her marriage, that's very deliberate, and it's a very deliberate... connection between the two of them and their professional lives versus their personal lives. And it's deliberately there. It's deliberately there in Parkwood Murders. It will continue to be there in the next books. And yeah, so there's a plan for it. But
bit of an X-Files vibe.
Am I going to give him what he wants immediately in the next book? Absolutely not.
Back off, Russell.
Yes.
Get off my lawn.
Do you keep your books in a good condition, or are they a bit dogged? I find with hardbacks, I keep them in good condition, but I relish breaking the spines of paperbacks. All my paperbacks look very, very red.
Yeah, that's another thing we have in common we're discovering here. Okay. It's obviously the Formby training.
Yes, it is.
Hardbacks feel like they need to be treated with respect because they're grown-ups. And paperbacks, Me and my wife differ on this slightly. I will fold the corner of a page, although people give me bookmarks all the time now to stop me doing that. And I think there's a beautiful thing in cracking the spine of a book that you adore as you're just... Yeah, so I love that. They're physical objects, I think, and they are... You're in a relationship with a paperback, and it's like part of your heart for a while. They're tactile objects.
Yeah, also they're kind of made to be taken on the beach or on the train or wherever it is that you're going. It can put up with anything.
Yeah.
And if it gets a bit battered, then it doesn't matter.
Well, it's careworn, isn't it?
That's care-worn. The thing. That's the word. If you hadn't become superstar screenwriter and author, is there another job or a completely different career that you could see yourself doing?
Probably something. I mean, I always wanted to be something in the entertainment industry but it always felt impossible. I didn't know anybody in any of those industries. When I was a teenager, I thought maybe I'd like to be a journalist. I spent days sort of work placement at the Liverpool Daily Post when that was still going. Yeah. And so that possibly, or I would love to have directed, maybe in theatre, something like that. But my dad sold insurance and pensions for a living, went into an office every day and did all that and commuted a lot. And that never really appealed to me, and stayed with one company his whole life and did all that. And I really... I didn't want that when I was growing up.
Do you remember the first book you bought with your own money? Makes a big difference.
Oh, do you know? I don't. I really don't. That's a really difficult one.
No. Nothing, no.
No. It was probably... Well, it would have been... I'm pretty certain it would have been either a Famous Five, Secret Seven, or a Terence Dix Doctor Who novelisation.
Oh, yeah.
Because they were cheap and they were thin and they were. So it would probably, I bet if I went back in my TARDIS, I would find myself doing that.
Think about the Famous Five, because I used to read those to my kids for a while, you know, and then obviously they grow. Is that as whodunits? They were never very good because it was always the kid from the circus, always, or the slightly swarthy person.
Yeah.
It was always them. There's always a kind of, oh, are you sure he did? I'm not sure.
Yeah, and yes, and there's some class issues, and to say the least.
Just a bit. So finally, Chris, you are throwing a fantasy dinner party.
Yeah,
and you can invite three authors, living or dead. Who's coming?
I would like to invite, number one, I'd like to invite Douglas Adams.
Oh. Well.
Because of his incredible genius as a writer, as a comic writer, and also as an observer of the world and a predictor of the world. I just would love to have met him. Would love to spend some time in his company.
Wouldn't have been good. He'd have been so great on social media. You know, he would have just lived there before getting cheesed off like everyone else.
yeah, and you'd love to have him around as an interpreter of the world now, I think.
Okay, Douglas Adams.
Then I would like, I'd like Geoffrey Chaucer, please, author of the Canterbury Tales. And obviously he was one of the first books ever published in this country by Caxton. So I would like him because he had the most amazing life. He's also the first author to write in vernacular English, you know, at a point when Latin and French are the major languages. So, and I studied the Canterbury Tales at A level, and I love their life and sense of dialect that he brings into writing. So I think that would be great. I'd like to see him and Douglas Adams having a chat.
Interesting, yeah.
And then I'd like Donna Tartt, please, author of The Secret History and The Goldfinch, and because it takes a long time for her to write these masterpieces, and I would really like to just spend some time and hear her in conversation with these other two. I think she's an absolute genius, and I love that she gives very few interviews, and you don't really know that much about her. And I think, from the rare interviews I have seen with her, I think she'd be an amazing dinner guest.
Okay, well, that's an interesting... So that's you, Donna Tartt, Geoffrey Chaucer and Douglas Adams.
How's that? How does that compare generally? No,
that's pretty good. I always at this point usually mention the person.
One of two things you're going to mention now. I'm going to go on. You just mentioned one.
Well, you've mentioned Agatha Christie a lot.
Yeah.
Who was it? Was it Ragnar Sjoneson?
No, it was Alex Michaelides.
Alex Michaelides, who invited Agatha Christie, but then said, "But the trouble is, the only thing that she would drink was full fat cream."
That's right. And she
at
was
that
also,
point you go,
what?
Oh dear, that's not a great dinner.
No, and she was very shy as well. If you ever see, I think there's one filmed interview with her, possibly outside the Mousetrap or a film premiere, and she's very shy. And she was number four, but then I was also, I bumped her for Chaucer, which is not a sentence you often find yourself saying.
No, that's very good. Chris, thank you very much. The Parkwood Murders by Chris Chibnall, published by Michael Joseph, and is out now. You can email the show anytime, booksoftheyear@yahoo.com. Get in touch via our socials at Books of the Year. Hope you can join us next week when our guest will be international best-selling superstar David Baldacci. Thank you for listening.